Very welcome back to The Late Debate. On this programme in recent months, we have debated the harmful effects of tobacco and alcohol. Tonight, it's the turn of food. We keep being told we are on the threshold of an obesity epidemic, and government-produced figures show that 61% of all adults and 25% of three-year-olds are overweight or obese. So tonight, we'll discuss the extent of the problem, the implications of it, and what is and what should be done to address it. And we have experts in their field with us tonight. Joining me in studio are Dr. Miriam Owens, who is a public health specialist in the Department of Health. Professor Donal O'Shea is a consultant endocrinologist and director of the Weight Management Clinic at St. Columbkilles and St. Vincent's Hospitals in Dublin. Ella McSweeney is a food specialist, journalist and broadcaster. Andrew Doyle is chairman of the Oireachtas Agriculture and Food Committee. And Paul Kelly is director of the food and drink sector with the employers group IBEC. And later tonight, we'll hear from our regular columnist, the author and comedian Colm O'Regan, with his views on this issue. So you're all very welcome indeed to the programme. Lots to talk about between now and 11. Professor Donal O'Shea, I'll start with you. In your assessment, how bad is the obesity problem in Ireland?
Well, the obesity problem in the developed world is not just Ireland, is recognised to be public health priority number one. And I think Ireland is very high in the adult statistics for obesity, where we have 25% of our adults are obese and a further 40% are overweight. So it's now unusual to be of normal weight in this country. That's a massive change from 30 years ago. Kids, we have the slightly encouraging news yesterday that one in five of our five-year-olds are overweight or obese. And that's a slight reduction from a couple of years back. And that's, you know, a chink of light. But our childhood stats still have us really there with Greece and Malta and the UK chasing the US stats, where it's 33%, maybe coming down a little towards 30% overweight or obese. So, and we now know, you know, obesity came along disguised as progress and plenty, but we now know it causes every disease that we are treating and makes every disease it causes worse without appearing on one death cert or very few death certs. So it's very hard to track, a really formidable opponent.
Dr. Mary Mones, how worried are you about the obesity problem here?
Well, personally, as a public health specialist and as a member of the Department of Health, we are very concerned. As Donal said, you know, it's a worldwide problem. Ireland is fastly approaching some of the statistics that we see in the US. And, you know, it's coming to the stage in the developed world where this generation of adults could well be the first generation to outlive their children. So we have to do something. Like, our children are our biggest asset. We need to do something about it. So it is, it's, you know, it's a concern for us. And that's why the government has launched Healthy Ireland, which is a framework for improved health and well-being over the next 12 to 15 years. It's a new framework to improve the health and well-being of the population and to deal with health inequalities in particular as one of its actions and goals. It's a new document, but it's drawing on existing strategies and policies in how it works. It will proposing a new way of working, so it's a new approach that's whole of government, whole of society. You know, it's everybody's responsibility, so we all need to work together. And we are putting in place some structures to harness that cross-sectoral work.
Well, we'll debate the government strategy later in the programme. Ella McSweeney, in terms of the extent of the problem, I mean, all we have to do is look around us. We're getting fatter. I mean, it's there on the street.
It's absolutely there on the street. There was a kind of an alarming paper published by Professor Ivan Perry down in UCC last week, which predicts if we don't have interventions by 2030, you're talking about an 85% overweight obese in adult females and 89% in males, costing the HSE somewhere in the region of 5.4 billion euro a year. 5.4 billion euro. And the question is, why hasn't this been averted? I mean, I've been reading papers back in the late 70s that have been predicting this. The late Dr John Keaveney in Trinity College, 1981, said we need a food strategy, a food policy, because diet-related diseases are on the increase and we are eating too much food. One thing I would also add, though, in terms of the dysfunction of the food system in Ireland is food poverty. 5 Croke Parks jammed full of people is a number of people, or the number of people who experience food poverty in Ireland today. And I was at a food poverty conference last week, and a teacher from Limerick gave a talk, and she said, children are coming in hungry. We have kids having the faints because they have not eaten in 15 hours. It's kind of Dickensian, but this is today in Ireland. You have on the one spectrum, you have, you know, people who are fainting, children who are fainting because they haven't eaten enough. And on the other side, you have, as Donal said, 1 in 5 5-year-olds is overweight or obese. So it is a huge problem, but one that is, it's baffling why this hasn't been averted, because researchers have been calling for a food policy for decades. Mm. And researchers have been pointing out that this is what is going to happen. And sure enough, here we are, 2013, it's happened.
And Andrew Doyle, when you look at government policies, we've had them recently in terms of tobacco. James Riley very stridently opposing, you know, all things to do with tobacco and trying to clamp down on that, advertising, etc. And we've had Alex White in the last few weeks launching his alcohol policy as well. But very little, if nothing, in terms of trying to tackle obesity.
Well, I'm not so sure. Like, there is definitely a problem. I'm not so sure that nothing has been done. I mean, Dr. Owens has just mentioned the Healthy Ireland strategy, which is an action plan developed by the whole of government with the cross-departmental. And I think what the minister, I think probably our debate today is as a result of the publishing of the study on growing up in Ireland for the under fives and under threes, where the statistic that Donal references comes in, where there is a slight improvement between 1 and 3s, between 3-year-olds and 5-year-olds. Look, there's, as has been said, this is not a problem that's unique to Ireland. The solutions are, apart from just diet, it's lifestyle. It's sedentary. I remember somebody who was an NGO said to me at one stage when they came back that there was as many people on diets on the planet as there was starving, you know. And what Ella has outlined is a mirror image of what's happening across the planet. And I think we have to look at certain things beyond just the food thing. I mean, we can be very simplistic and take one unilateral action that will maybe, like the sugar tax is one. But, you know, on its own, if you were to apply it, will it actually solve the obesity problem? I doubt it. Mm. So I think you have to have a multi sort of pronged approach to it. And just, you know, it was mentioned our children are our greatest resource, and we all know that. And it's not just a cliche, but we've been happy enough to use children for green schools programs to make people aware of recycling, of renewable energy, and we're quite contented to use that as the conduit into the parents and into people. I, many years ago, was on the old health board, and there was an adult early school leaving class for mothers, and a dietitian out of St. Colum Kills actually provided a module on healthy eating. Mm. And you know, when we talk about food poverty, there's two things comes out of healthy eating. One is that it's better for you. The second is that it's cheaper. And we haven't educated the people, and there's a huge awareness campaign. Convenience, highly processed food, no matter whether it's cheap or expensive, is not good for you.
Okay.
In large amounts.
Donal O'Shea, what's your assessment of the government's approach to this issue?
Well, I have to say, overall, I'm impressed with the position it's taking. But a position needs to be followed up by action. So all the right noises are now being made. The Healthy Ireland framework and document is the most progressive step that has been taken, certainly during my time looking at this. Even if you look at other countries, it's very good on paper, but it's still on paper. Yeah. And unless it's resourced and actioned, then we look like, you know, a laughing stock. And just to come back to one thing you mentioned about James Riley, I mean, I think as Minister for Health, he's having a tough time, and I don't think history will look back particularly friendly on him. But he has pushed obesity from the day he came into office, actually. Mm-hmm. He got it on the EU agenda for when we were presidents, and Greece looked like they're going to take it forward and put childhood obesity as a key strategy for the EU in the first half of next year. That's massive. And also, he's prepared to say he battles himself with his bulge, you know, and he's not shy about saying that. And people need to hear that. you know, people need to hear. Everyone struggles with their weight. So it's not really a surprise in one way, Ella, that we're in this position, because, you know, human nature is addictive. Food is lovely. And therefore, when the weight goes on, God, it's tough to lose it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. It's tough to give it up. Ella, what's your assessment of Healthy Ireland? This framework strategy.
I hate to go against what Donal, given his profession, is saying, but my assessment of Healthy Ireland is in some ways quite opposite of what Donal is saying, which is I find it entirely baffling in itself as to what exactly it is saying when it comes to obesity. I mean, I think James Riley is very impressive in terms of tobacco, and he even has, as far as I know, a tobacco control unit in the department, and he has strong ambitions to rid Ireland of tobacco, and he's prepared to talk about it as if it's a war. When it comes to food, the food industry and obesity, I think it's very easy to talk about health. No one's going to disagree with that. But in terms of what is actually in there, a lot of it is about personal responsibility. And I think I would argue quite strongly that personal responsibility has got us where we are now. I mean, one document that is quite interesting that was never published by the Department of Health is the National Nutrition Policy of 2010. I've got a copy of the document here. It's a 50-page document. It takes a population health approach. It identifies sort of key actors in the food system. So it's not just about the food industry and then us, the consumers, but also NGOs, civil society, industry, obviously, the government and all the rest. It talks about the targeting of children. 84% of food adverts targeted children in Ireland were high in salt, sugar and fat. But And it talks about food poverty, which, as far as I'm aware, Healthy Ireland doesn't really talk about food poverty. One thing that I think is key to the document, which may have been the reason why it was never published, is one short paragraph which says, "It is essential to move away from placing responsibility exclusively on the individual to addressing the environmental factors that influence how and what people eat. This shift in focus will require strong cross-sectoral commitment." So basically what it's saying is we need to move away from this old idea that it's all just individuals on their own. We need to move away from that towards the obesogenic environment. It talks about the obesogenic environment. So it has recommendations like remove all food marketing from Irish schools. Don't market to the children. And then, you know, don't expect children to be able to resist the temptation, but they need more help than that. But this document was never published.
Right.
It sits on the shelf. And you have to ask why. And then when you read Healthy Ireland, there are a lot of good positive things in there for sure. I am not convinced that there are good policy things there when it comes to food and tackling obesity.
OK, Miriam, do you want to defend that?
Yes, I take many of your points, Ella, as being valid, because we, in the past, I suppose, we have been, as a government and a country, tackling things individually. So we've been tackling risk factors, so whether it's been smoking, a lot of work has been done there, alcohol, obesity, physical activity. What we're trying to do in Healthy Ireland is try to deal with these factors collectively. Because, you know, they don't sit alone. They cluster within individuals, they cluster with communities. So here, you know, up to date, there have been some successes because the message of healthy eating gets through to some people. Some people are, it's easier to make the healthier choices. It depends on where you're living and what your socioeconomic circumstances are. So Healthy Ireland is using many sort of valuable documents that have been developed over the last number of years and using a new way of bringing them to life, through the cross-sectoral working that we are doing. We have a number of groups together. We had one very, very productive meeting earlier this week with senior people from all government departments and from some key agencies who have really, you know, they really get the message about Healthy Ireland and about the need to work together. Because as we know, you know, the health system deals with illness and disease. The things that cause ill health rest outside our remit.
Is there joined up thinking in government when it comes to dealing with this issue?
There is. And I think that is exemplified by the fact that, you know, the entire cabinet is behind the launch and the, you know, the implementation of Healthy Ireland. We have a very unique photograph which we use and we present a number of times with all cabinet ministers holding Healthy Ireland. And I don't think there's many policy documents where that's happened before. And the Taoiseach himself is wants us to report to the Cabinet Committee on Social Policy regularly. We're an agenda item. So he's very behind it. He's very in favour of what
Ella,
we're doing.
Can I give you just one quick example of where there needs to be joined up thinking and why a food policy, an overall food policy, would be helpful? And that is in Navan. A KFC has been given planning permission right beside the entrance to a secondary school of 650 girls, and right, which is beside a primary school. So the Department of Environment has nothing really to say when it comes to planning and health. Mm-hmm. Walk in 2 yards into the school gates and the principal, Mary Mulligan, there has to implement a healthy food policy under the Department of Education guidelines. So there is this completely not joined up thinking in her mind between what she is striving very hard to do and what has been granted at the entrance to her school. Now, Meath County Council, as an example of individual responsibility, said that it's not the remit of the council to adjudicate on the food consumption habits of people. They said this is a matter of personal choice and personal responsibility. And I think that there's you could argue quite strongly that in that situation, children need to be protected from temptation if they're trying to be healthy. If they are doing basketball, as I went, at 9 a.m. for an hour, they should slightly be protected from the temptation, as the PE teacher said to me, of the smells wafting over. Mm-hmm. One example of joined up thinking not being there in the government.
And we have another example in Greystones, which we'll hear from now in just a second. But do you accept that that doesn't make sense, Miriam?
Yes, I agree. It doesn't make sense. And that's what we're trying to do in the future. We are trying to, you know, develop this joined up approach. It's not easy. It hasn't happened in other countries easily, and most countries are struggling with it. But it is something we, you know, will have to try and work on, because joined up approach is the only show in town, really.
And you know, the Greystones and Navan examples of locating a fast food outlet right beside or close to a school, that flies in the face of World Health Organization recommendations, OECD recommendations. And we look very silly if we're kind of all launching a healthy Ireland and we're allowing that to continue. That's what I mean by, you know, that's a good document if implemented actively and aggressively.
OK, well, Ella mentioned Navan and KFC. The fast food giant McDonald's has been granted planning permission to open in Black Lion Shopping Centre in Greystones in County Wicklow. And that, too, is close to a number of schools. Some people there are worried about that. Others, though, welcome the job opportunities. Donal O'Herlihy visited Greystones this afternoon and got the views of some of the locals.
That would not be a good idea. We have enough in the shops, and we have plenty around here. We don't need it close to the schools.
Do you think the government should be stepping in and actually trying to stop fast food?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, what do we have a government for? Only to protect the citizens. And definitely, we don't need a McDonald's close to a school. We here in Greystones, we have plenty of cafes, and the kids come in. At least they're coming in to it. They're not so, it's not there, you know, on their doorstep. And I think that's a bad idea. All the schools tend to, I'm only new living here, so all the schools tend to go in, go that way. There are a number of schools that way. There are. And then, of course, they come off the bus from Bray. The kids come from Bray, and they come off the bus there quite a lot. Okay. A lot of them live around there. So, yes, they would have a good catchment, wouldn't they?
Well, it's up to parents to make a decision about whether or not they allow their children to go to McDonald's. And in that context, it's a free world. Mm. So if McDonald's want to be allowed, I personally wouldn't be too happy about it. But as I say, it's up to parents of all kinds to make their own mind up about whether or not to bring the children to it.
So you don't feel that the government should step in, the Department of the Environment should block planning for these places close to schools?
No, absolutely not. I mean, where would you start and where would you stop, you know?
I think with children, when you're trying to keep their diet well, I think that would be wouldn't it be a temptation when they come out of school to run in, you know? And given that there's such an obesity problem in Ireland, I think it would be, well, I think it would anyway, you know, because kids on their own wouldn't have the same common sense if they were with their parents, you know, and I think they might go in. It's amazing they got permission to put it near a school, isn't it?
Do you think in general the government should step in when it comes to high salt, high fat, high sugar foods?
I don't really. I think, you know, as adults, we have to take, use our own common sense. And I mean, if it's written on the boxes now, you don't need the government to tell you what to do, you know. So unless you're very stupid, you can find it.
No, I think we really need to kind of take control of what the kids are eating. You know, a bit of education and not be putting temptation like that right under their noses.
Do you feel that the government should be stepping in and refusing planning to big fast food chains?
Well, I sort of feel we're all paying tax for everything, and I think that maybe food like that that's not good for you, it's harmful, is increasing our health bills and giving the children bad eating habits. I think foods like that should be taxed.
It was Donal O'Hurley. He's talking to some people in Greystones this afternoon. Andrew Doyle, you're the local TD. Do you support McDonald's getting planning permission to open there?
Well, before I answer that directly, I think there is, you heard the two on the for and against there earlier about whether it's a choice. I think the best way, and we're just talking about it, is if we have a planning application that affects the environment, our heritage, Antashka are a notifiable organisation. Mm-hmm. The NRA are where it's roads, the fisheries are where there's a fisheries con. So it's given that object independence to make a case. It's notified of the planning. It can then make a case.
But from your point of view, what takes priority? Is it jobs or is it health?
You can't just, you know, encourage job creation at the expense of health. The argument is this at the expense of health directly? I mean, and one man said there, where do you draw the line between being a sort of a nanny state and allowing, you know, responsibility on parents? But definitely the case, the same as what Ella outlined in Navan, where you have temptation wafting. I mean, we're told, and Donal would agree, if you want to go into a supermarket, the shop, you should have eaten first so that you don't pick things up that you don't really need.
So to answer the question then,
and I think
on the planning permission for McDonald's,
I would have grave reservations about it, I'd be honest. I welcome the jobs, I have to, you know, I mean, I think it's good, and I think people will go to a McDonald's somewhere, they'll seek it out, but it may be being too convenient is not a good idea.
Yeah.
And McDonald's, in fairness, are one of the big fast food outlets that have bought into the thing about healthier options on there, and they're a major purchaser of Irish beef as well, the biggest by volume that we have.
A huge employer in Ireland too. So but I think you could implement the recommendations from the 2005 Task Force on Obesity, which recommend that within planning, you need to give planners the permission to say this isn't exactly the right spot. There's nothing wrong with McDonald's, but it is strategically placing it so that we lessen the impact, particularly when it comes to children.
And possibly, and I don't know the full details of it, the criteria that was used for the establishment of that wasn't necessarily that the schools were there. I know where Black Lion is and there's vacant property there, which there isn't a lot of, ironically, in Greystones, because it's the lowest vacant units in the county, certainly. So there could have been a piece of that about it, and it would have enhanced that shopping centre, or if it gets to go ahead. So
okay, a couple of texts. John says, I'm a secondary school teacher. Our school has healthy eating policies, but the privately run canteen in the school sells a lot of junk. Doesn't make any sense to him. And Mary's in Killorglin says, you're right, Ella, self-responsibility for food, our own health, our environment, our towns, our homes and jobs and friends and drugs and relationships. We must be helped now by government to realise it's our own responsibility to help ourselves. Paul Kelly from IBEC, you're director of the food and drink sector with IBEC. Where do you stand on this question of whether it's personal responsibility or a government-led action to curb this issue?
I think it's a bit of both, and I think that's a reflection of the complexity of the issue. I mean, I think certainly people have individual responsibility. Some of the things the food industry does, and I think the food industry sees itself as part of the solution, and obviously as the producer of the food in the first place that people are consuming, you could argue in a fashion they're part of the problem as well. Some of the things we do revolve around better information on pack, so people can actually make the informed choices because of the nutritional information that's on pack. But there's also other things we're involved in, like, say, reformulation, where you're looking at reducing salt levels, reducing sugar levels and so on. And generally, they're done in concert with the regulatory authorities, in the case of Ireland, with the food safety authority. So you could say, in a sense, it's a semi-societal response. But just to take that example and maybe build on it and demonstrate some of the level of complexity around that, you don't look at just salt reduction and go do it. It's very, very complex. There can be a consumer reaction to the whole thing, and you need to underpin it with both science and data. So there'll be a huge amount of data developed in terms of population intakes. The Department of Agriculture would have funded a number of salt reduction projects through the universities working with the companies. And over the last 9 or 10 years, slowly but surely, and it has to happen slowly but surely because you've got to re-educate the consumer palate, we've seen a reduction in the salt content of processed foods. But we've also seen at the same time an increase in the discretionary addition of salt by people at home when they're cooking and when they're actually adding it at the table. So we're part of the way there, but now we need to start to look at things like, say, well, how do we actually educate people in terms of their salt intake, both looking at the actual information on pack and allowing them to make even more informed decisions, but also in terms of that discretionary addition as well.
And where do you stand on the likes of the proposals for a sugar tax? Do you oppose that?
Yeah, we don't think they'll work. We think they're purely fiscal measures. We don't think they'll have any impact from a health perspective. We've seen the example of Denmark, which brought in a tax on saturated fats in 2011. In 2012, 12 months later, they removed it, and they also withdrew proposals for the introduction of a sugar tax. And the reason they did that was that people voted with their feet. They headed across the border into Germany. Now, we've had a similar situation here a few years ago when people were heading north of the border, and the Department of Finance did a number of surveys, and they showed the loss of tax and excise to the Exchequer was in excess of 120 to 140 million euros. So you get these unintended consequences. As it stands already, a number of the products which are generally looked at when we talk about things like sugar tax, they already have the standard VAT rate of 23% applied to them. In Ireland and the UK are relatively unusual in Europe that the majority of our food products are actually zero rated for VAT, so they carry the zero rate. We have some products at about, say, 10 or 12%. So they already carry that differential.
Donal O'Shea, you support a sugar tax?
I do support a sugar tax, and I think, you know, the some of the examples given, the salt reduction has been slow really, and it's done country by country. And in Belgium, you have to go through three different districts to reduce salt in each district. So this needs to go right up to an EU level. So you won't have cross-border. You will have a pan-EU thing that will. And that's why I'm delighted that the Irish have got childhood obesity on the EU agenda. Because if it can happen at an EU level, then brilliant. You know, the Danes introduced a saturated fat tax without any consultation with any health agencies. It was a political decision, totally fiscal, and they removed it again, change of government, political decision to remove it without any interrogation of would it work or did it work.
What do you think a sugar tax would achieve?
The sugar tax that I was supporting for introduction here was detailed health impact assessment before it, small amount of money raised, not a fiscal measure. Of the order of, I think, 60 or 70 million, which in the overall scheme of things is tiny. And there is evidence that it would impact on obesity rates within a 3-year period. Now, if it didn't, then get rid of it, you know. But bring it in, because we're at a stage with the obesity problem where we simply can't do nothing. Mm-hmm. We have to make our best guess at what might work. You talk about jobs, and I'm all for jobs. And if you put fast food outlets close to, you know, high density populations, eating behaviour changes. So you create jobs in KFC, you create jobs in the health sector because of the chronic disease you cause. You boost jobs in the undertaking business. So it is actually as simple as jobs versus lives when it comes to things like planning long term.
Paul.
Yeah, well, just to say, I mean, take the example of Belgium. Belgium obviously is a federal state, so there are actually three state governments there. And at European level, it has been addressed. We have the European Salt Network. The Department of Health would be involved in that. They did set a 4-year target for a 16% reduction in salt. And the work that's been ongoing here since 2004 and 2005, from the FSAI and from the Department of Health, has plugged into that. Yes,
it's a very good example of how slowly things can work and how little it can change over time.
But again, you know, when you talk about it happening slowly, if you go back to the original strategy document which was produced, which led to the salt reduction for they deliberately set out as part of that strategy that it would happen on a slow basis. And the reason for that, more than anything else, was that you wouldn't turn off consumers. You can produce a product in the morning that has little or no salt. You put it on the shelves, it won't be bought. So you need to do this slowly but surely. And it has been successful. Salt content in bread. Bread is a relatively low salt product, but we actually consume quite an amount of it. So it's the single largest component of salt from processed foods.
But what's your opposition to a sugar tax, Paul? Is it purely from an economic point of view? It's too costly.
It's costly. It sends the wrong signal, and we believe it's just one of these. It's great to get sort of the political headlines. It won't have any effect. It's also worth noting.
How do you know that though? It won't have any effect.
It won't have any effect because when you actually look at the data from IUNA, the Irish Universities Nutrition Alliance. The BMI of consumers of carbonated soft drinks versus those who are non-consumers of the drinks is roughly the same, both for the child cohort, for the adolescent cohort, and for the adult cohort. It's also worth bearing in mind that over the last 10 years, we've seen a 20% reduction in the volume consumption of soft drinks in the Irish market. And that's been driven by two factors. One is a degree of changing consumer preferences, and the other is obviously the economic situation.
Do you accept those figures, Donal, in terms of the consumption of sugary drinks?
The figures may be wrong, but they're dated.
No, the figures are right. They're industry figures, and it's also worth as well.
They're industry figures, yeah.
Yeah, they're industry figures. They're the actual
and
volume figures.
We now have, in the last 18 months, the randomised control trial evidence, which is level one evidence in the medical circle. And I don't have an industry or I don't have a Department of Health agenda. I just have an obesity agenda. Mm-hmm. We have the evidence that these drinks are linked to overweight and obesity in kids. If you impact on their consumption, that you impact positively on the child's body mass index. And we have the sale by GlaxoSmithKline of its interest in Lucozade Sport and Ribena when the publication came out that showed that per can of sugar-sweetened drink you consume, you increase your risk of developing diabetes. GlaxoSmithKline had no option corporately but to sell a profitable growing arm of their business because they make treatment for diabetes and cancer at the other end of their portfolio. So they were, that I think is a tobacco-like tipping point in this whole debate.
What do you say to that, Paul? I mean, you don't accept that evidence.
I don't accept that evidence. And again, when you look at the IUNA data, what you see is that it's between 2-3% of calorific intake. That's the reality.
The IUNA data shows that our 5 to 12-year-olds are consuming an average of 63 calories from sugar sweetened drinks every day. That is 3 weeks of their total energy intake in the year in something that should be occasional. So, the argument on the role sugar-sweetened drinks play is over, and it's how do we change behaviour, and is it personal or is it government? And I mean, we mentioned the contributors. There's 172 different contributors to the obesity problem when you map them all out. They fall into 7 broad groups. 3 are personal, 4 are societal and environmental. And you have to address both, which is what you were saying. Yeah. It's both need to be addressed.
Miriam, a sugar tax, it's not on the government's agenda, is it?
It's something that the Department of Health had proposed for inclusion in the budget this year. It wasn't accepted. We didn't get it. It is something we're very concerned about, overweight and obesity, as I've already said, and choosing the wrong foods repeatedly in terms of food or drink is a concern to us. And we feel the sugar sweetened beverage tax would help in terms of reducing the amount consumed. And as Donal said, if the evidence is there that it will work. And if it turns out that it doesn't work, we would be looking at it again. But we are.
So again, Andrew Doyle, are the industry the big powerful lobbyists here?
Well, I just checked this because I anticipated that it could form a fairly major part of the discussion. And my update on is the report on the steering group. There has been established a subcommittee on one action, which is to restrict the availability of food and drinks, sweetened sugar, from the top shelf of the food pyramid. I would suggest, because there's a couple of factors here. One is just to simply tax sugar if that solved the obesity, as I said earlier, I don't think anybody would object to it, but it won't. What we have to try and do is customise people to a different taste. The salt is one. If there was perhaps an incentive to reduce sugar, first of all, so reduce sugar content as opposed to taxing it, that people wouldn't buy it and they would buy alternative sweetened products which have other health issues, maybe not obesity ones, but they certainly, there's some evidence, I'm not an expert, but I'm told that there's some evidence about, you know, if you were to change from a sweetened cola to a diet cola, that, and you consume the same amount that Donal referenced in consumption, you wouldn't be doing yourself any great favours from a health perspective either. So, like, moderation comes into it. But if we could get people accustomed to reduced sugar intake, and diabetics, like, I mean, there are products out there, and from Donal's other work, diabetics can't eat sugar. Yeah. You know, they might have to have a Mars bar or something, or a Lucozade or whatever for a rush, but they don't consume sugar in their main diet, and they're it's necessity.
But the aim is to prevent more people from getting diabetes.
Mm-hmm. And diabetes is caused, a major cause of diabetes seems to be obesity, and it's not a fact that's disputed.
Ella, what's your view on this sugar tax? I mean, someone is texting, why isn't fructose banned from food, sweet and soft drinks, or tax it heavily? It produces a craving to eat more when a person consumes it.
I mean, I think I take on board what Donal says about the evidence for a sugar tax. I would certainly favour a sugar tax over a fat tax, which I think would be a big mistake, because I think that our ideas about what fat does to us are very old-fashioned, and in fact we need a lot of fat in our diet. Well, certain amount of fat in our diet. But what I would say is a bit broader. I mean, to me, we can talk individually about all the different actions that can happen. You know, a sugar tax or not, removing vending machines from secondary schools that are selling this sugar perhaps would be a start. But a food policy, getting back to the idea of something that addresses the whole range of issues associated with food as a whole, means that it's a much broader approach than just deciding, will we have a sugar tax or not? And if it doesn't work out, well, then we'll just, you know, give up on it. I mean, it strikes me that the biggest challenge for the 21st century, as we know, and I know this from farming, is to be able to feed people in an ecologically sound way, given climate change and biodiversity and water and resource limitations, to feed them in an equitable way so that we don't have five croque parks full of people who are experiencing food poverty, and to feed them in a healthy way so that we aren't in 2030. I mean, we talk about the nanny state, the HSC, the Department of Health is going to pick up the bill by 2030 to the tune of 5.4 billion euro a year in order to deal with overweight and obesity. So it seems to me that an overall umbrella policy that all departments in the government have to sign up to would address this more holistically. I mean, you know, when we talk about making healthy choices, I mean, for an awful lot of people in Ireland, the idea of choice is a luxury. You know, I mean, it is cheaper to eat unhealthily than it is to eat fruit and veg and, for example, fish. This is what the research certainly says anyway. And I was interested to read the 1995 Food and Nutrition Policy for Ireland. And it says we need to encourage in our agriculture more fruit and veg production, so that it is easier and more accessible and cheaper for us to be able to access it. But instead, we have this thing where we're importing 500 million euro worth of fruit and veg. And while we're aiming under Food Harvest 2020, the big agri-food policy, to feed 50 million people a year. So this, a lot of different complexities. And it's why food policy is so difficult, because it is what they call a contested space. Everyone has a say. Everyone has a vested interest in it.
You can eat healthily, cheaply. Mm. It's just much more difficult. Yeah. Access to the fruit and veg at the right kind of price is more difficult. But you can eat and feed a family of five healthily cheaper than to go to a fast food outlet.
And as was said in the food poverty conference the other day, you know, I would prefer a woman who was struggling to feed her kids because she didn't have enough money to do so. You know, I prefer to fill them up than to hear them cry of hunger in the middle of the night. Is a reason why you may fill your children up with unhealthy foods. I mean, I don't think, you know, we can ever dismiss individual responsibility. We have to, as part of who we are. But I certainly think that on balance, you know, Healthy Ireland talks an awful lot about individual responsibility. It has a section on building community and personal responsibility. And I would be concerned that it has gone towards the personal responsibility too much and not towards what was here in 2010, the working document on the National Nutrition Policy that says things like, let's deal with marketing to children in schools. Vending machines, I say it again, is such a simple thing. Take vending machines out of schools. 40% of secondary schools in Ireland have vending machines selling stuff that isn't good for kids.
In fairness, why are they there? In fairness, most new big schools that are opened have a very clear policy on who's going to take ownership and who's going to run and manage, and there's clear protocols in place.
Okay, Paul first. Yeah.
Again, you know, the vending machine issue comes up regularly. They're in there at the invitation of the schools, but the reason they're in there is because they make money for the schools.
The schools make money, so, they do,
and,
yeah.
And again, the issue here really is, I think, the level of funding that schools are actually getting. So, you know, if again, it comes back, I think, to your point about sort of an overall food policy literally gets as far as issues about, well, what's the sort of the capitation grant that schools get, because that ultimately influences things like this.
Miriam.
Yes, I just want to refer to an obesity campaign, which you may be aware of, is running at the moment. It started launched at the end of October. And this is an all-island campaign that Healthy Ireland and HSE are running with Safe Food. And it has built up on a lot of information that has come from parents through focus groups, where, you know, parents are aware that there's a problem, mm-hmm. but what they are looking for is practical ways, practical help in how to
address. Portion sizes.
The portion size is the first one. The other thing is about sleep, screen time, front of television, front of PlayStations, physical activity, and giving parents sort of some help and information as how to say no, to look at treats. Food treats, you know, they're treats. They're not everyday occurrences. So that is going some way towards helping, you know, help parents make the choices themselves and for their children.
I think
and
that,
as a family.
I mean, it's interesting, the Safe Food campaign, because it is very, very full of information and very important. Certainly the parents are given that information very clearly, and it can be commended on that level. Again, personal responsibility. It's saying to parents, you deal with it. So I take my child to the supermarket, and what is there at his eye level? Loads and loads and loads and loads of sweets and chocolate and everything. And then I go to the till and there's chocolate and everything. There are easy measures here. One other thing about choice when it comes to selecting and trusting food labels is the Food Safety Authority of Ireland has had its budget cut by 15% in the last 5 years. It has had a 15% reduction in staff numbers as well. It's responsible for labelling. I'm not clear it has the budget to do that. And so we need to, when we're talking about choice, also be aware of having the resources behind that and making sure that labelling, people can trust what they read and what they see.
That's a big issue. Donald.
The labelling is a massive issue for people to understand what food they're having, and the consumers have made it absolutely clear they want traffic light labelling for their foods. I mean, time and again it comes out, 90% ratings as their preference, and yet that has not got through at an EU level. Mm-hmm. Primarily because of significant industry opposition to it, which I can understand from an industry point of view, but that has won out in the political voting, with unfortunately Fine Gael swinging that vote and the party they're a member of in Europe swinging that vote against the traffic light system, which is really disappointing, you know. And I think we really do need to look at getting this higher up the chain within government. It is now at the level of the Taoiseach, which is really important, but then up to EU, so that the cross-border problem that is a problem from an industry point of view disappears.
I think, though, that what's interesting is that you can wait for the EU, but at the local level, there's an awful lot of interesting things happening. One would be the establishment recently of the Cork Food Policy Council by Dr. Colin Sage and a few others, Catherine Harford of Neat down in Knocknaheeny as well, which is advocating for policy based on health outcomes. So at the local level, you have people arguably giving up on government to be able to solve this. You have an awful lot of community gardens. You have an awful lot of people in some ways just doing it for themselves and trying to make sure in Navan, a lot of the parents getting together and saying, we can't do this anymore. We're not doing this anymore. And they're objecting to the planning permission, as I mentioned earlier. So an awful lot of stuff happening at local level. But, you know, it should be matched.
Yeah, I'd just like to make the point here that part of the implementation of Healthy Ireland, and one of its strengths we feel, is the relationship we're building up with local government. Many, many local authorities are doing huge amounts of work, sometimes unrecognised, that can be you know, classified as health-related, health-benefiting work. And many local authorities are now are coming to us saying, look, we're doing this, we want to do more, or we want to, you know, pass on our experience to other local authorities. And it could well be that we...
At that level, it's very effective.
It is very effective. And, you know, it's easier to change communities than change countries. Okay, and I think that's what we have to work on.
We'll take a break from the discussion for a couple of minutes because our regular columnist, Colm O'Regan, has been thinking about this issue too. And here are his views.
We still talk about the burger in our house. One night after a gig up the north, I was starving. Coming home through the city centre in Dublin, I stopped at a chipper near home and ordered possibly the dirtiest burgers I have ever seen in my life, plus a bushel of chips. I brought them home to an equally famished wife. We're not proud of what happened next. I think I accidentally ate the burger wrapper. It felt so wrong, yet it felt so good. Making your own soup will never compare to this. But recently, we've started trying to make soup at home. Apart from anything else, we feel smug, and smugness is a much underestimated natural Prozac. There is always a danger of pontificating from a middle-class standpoint at what people are eating, especially the poor. Luckily, Jamie Oliver gave us a handy tip on what not to say when he railed against the poor with their big-screen TVs instead of spending money on his fresh tomatoes. So let's get this out of the way first. When it comes to food, poor people, and especially the working poor, face challenges that the better off don't. Storage of food, access to decent shops, working longer hours, longer commutes, inadequate cooking facilities, possibly not a very big freezer, or in a few cases, children whose parents are off their heads. So the obesity argument has to hammer home one basic point. With a bit of housekeeping, eating reasonably healthily should be cheaper than eating shite. I know a woman who runs a cookery school in Douglas in Cork. She teaches the very basics of how to shop and cook. She reckons 4 or 5 lessons at about €24 a go will pay for themselves in a few weeks. Her customers are from all social strata, and many of them haven't a clue how to cook. She has taught surgeons on how to cut an onion. Imagine that, a person who can slice open an artery can't slice open an allium. I still can't believe we have an education system here where it is compulsory to learn about the effects of erosion and deposition in the mature stage of a river, where it is considered essential to know the 4 reasons why the Battle of Kinsale was lost, or where it is handy to know the Tishil Ginnadach. But it's not compulsory to learn how to defrost a fridge, make porridge, or put together a weekly shop, because it's only like, you know, the stuff that keeps you alive. Now, I loved geography. I'm fascinated why all our rebellions failed. But when your foot has gone black from gangrene from diabetes, knowing how to conjugate I walk, you walk, we walk, she walks in the Mo Cuinnilluc is going to be of scant consolation. I know I'm exaggerating, it's flowery prose, and you could argue that the parents should be teaching kids on what to do. But you know what? The parents are up the walls trying to find money for the property tax. We pay enough for this government, let them work as nannies for a while.
And that was Colm O'Regan there with his unique take, as always, on the issue of the night's debate. Donald, do you find anything in there to argue against?
To argue against? Apart from some of the language he used, the theme, tone and mood of it was actually on the button. And I think we're all saying something like it. I mean, teaching life skills in school is absolutely essential. Leaving school able to shop and cook. I think the target in the UK system now is that you'll be able to prepare from scratch 6 healthy meals when you leave school and have done it a number of times. And I think practical things like that we have to make sure are embedded into our teaching curriculum.
And Miriam, is that underway now? I mean, is that part of Healthy Ireland working with the Department of Education? Is this something that's happening now?
We are working with a number of government departments, the Department of Education and Children and ourselves, because we have, you know, a very common theme. So sort of there are 3 departments that have a role to play in health, a role to play in education. And the early intervention is, you know, there's evidence that the earlier you intervene in health, you get better, you know, better return in terms of health outcomes. You get a better return on your investments. So early education for children in terms of eating well, learning how to cook. There are many initiatives in the Department of Education are running in terms of, you know, school breakfast clubs, where there's a benefit for both the children and perhaps the parents who are, you know, who the whole food poverty angle is sort of being addressed there. Mm. But also, I think having people in an environment where they see actual porridge being made and, you know, toast being made and fruit smoothies being made, at least they're learning, seeing something there. So it is something we will be looking at in terms of how we can address what is a multifaceted and a very difficult problem, Paul?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the root of it. How do you get people back to cooking? And I think certainly
men back into cooking.
Yeah, well, again, just as it was just thinking about this, I was thinking of my two older kids at secondary school. The girl, they do home economics at school. The boy, no home economics in the boys' school. So, you know, you can see sort of the gender difference. The inequalities, I mean, and if you don't understand the basics of cooking, you're sort of a couple of steps behind. So again, you know, there has been, we can see it from consumer research, there's been a move of people moving back to cooking from scratch over the last few years. But I would imagine that they're people who know how to cook. The people who don't know how to cook for whatever reason really can't get that opportunity.
Andrew. Yeah, well, the tenet of Colm's contribution there was that it's up to the government. Now, not everything has to cost a fortune. And what Paul has said, it used to be a case that domestic science was taught. So what is the problem and what would it cost? Nothing, I would say, to include domestic science as part of the curriculum. And if I'm just to go developing on from that, not everything has to be done in a holistic fashion. There are things you can do which will have an impact on health. And just to make the point that not everything in North Wicklow is negative, Eamon Coughlin, my colleague, is launching a Points for Life exercise programme. And Donal, you, I think, were on the working group next Monday week on the 9th in a school in Bray and five pilot schools in North Wicklow. Yeah. And the point he makes is the rationale behind it is if I'm a school teacher teaching kids in any class in school, at the end of their fifth class, fourth class, whatever, I know how they should have progressed in English, Irish, maths and anything else. Yeah. I could teach them a really wonderful PE module, but I wouldn't be able to assess how they actually have progressed or not. And I mean, it has to become normal thinking. So it's to change the way we think about PE.
Yeah.
And if we put that in, and it's very easy to tack on other things around that. And as a result of doing that, dealing with obesity becomes easier. I'm not saying it cures it, but it's one measure that helps deal with it. If you had, I remember making a point about domestic science for girls, and my former colleague Avril Doyle called me to order and said, and the boys. Mm. And Ella has just said the same there. It is something that everybody needs to be aware of.
Exactly. Well, I want to read some text because there's a lot of people with views on this. And Derek in Wexford says, again, teach children how to cook. Nobody cooks anymore. Opening packets of pasta sauce is not cooking. It's a lost skill. Someone in Galway says, some of our GAA teams are sponsored by an omnipresent fast food joint deep in the psyche from a young age. It's a tragedy. Tony says, in relation to the planning permission for KFC and McDonald's beside schools in Wicklow and Meath, we are talking about a school, so stop waffling on about personal choice. Joe Fitzmaurice says access to nutrition has to be looked at. I cannot buy pulses or legumes in my local town without containing sugar. Someone else says it's ironic that it took me contracting a chronic health condition to change my diet. I now eat very healthily and I feel great. And just let me scroll on down here. Yeah, someone says the EU should ban trans fats. The FDA is considering this in the US. That's from Joe in Wexford. Would that be something you'd support, Donal?
I think we know trans fats are bad and they should be limited in foods. And I think, you know, Denmark have a ban on them, and the fast food outlets there have got rid of trans fats in line with that, but just in Denmark. But if they can do it there, why not everywhere? Mm. Now, when you cook food, you will inevitably, there will be some, fats will turn to trans fats in the cooking process. So there's always going to be an element of it, but it needs to be minimised.
Paul, do you have a position on that?
Yeah, again, I mean, the last research done on that here, FSAI 2008, did processed foods, and I think 57% had zero, and up to 80% were below the 2% level, which is considered low level of trans fats. Mm. And then I think the following year in 2009, they did fast food outlets and they found a fairly similar sort of results. So that there's been a significant downward trend on that. the two other relevant things is, of course, when you remove those, you're removing certain fats and oils and you're replacing them with others. And I think they had a concern about saturated fats at that stage. So that's sort of the next targeted area. The other relevant thing, we talked about the food labelling earlier on. And I mean, we're seeing it's coming in next year, the most fundamental change in 30 years in food labelling. But one of the things about that on the back of pack as opposed to the front of pack nutrition labelling is when we look at ingredients, when we look at things like, say, oils, that's going to have to sort of break out into the specific oils. So we'll see much greater detail in terms of the good oils and the bad oils on pack.
Just going back to the importance of skills like cooking. I mean, the teacher from Limerick who said that the children are coming in hungry, she is coordinator of this scheme called Cook It. I think it comes from Northern Ireland. You know, on the back of two startling statistics, 21% of Irish children go to bed or school hungry, and 13% of Irish children never eat a breakfast on the weekday. So this Cook It is trying to give them the skills to be able to cook their own porridge or whatever they want to have for breakfast and all the rest. And I think, you know, she has seen an absolutely amazing change in the children down there. But she said that there doesn't seem to be a joined up thinking where that can be fed up to the Department of Education, that information about what is happening on the ground. I think just finally, from my perspective, I mean, an awful lot of what has been said today, this evening rather, unfortunately, it isn't in the Healthy Ireland document. The kind of things that need to happen, the kind of actual changes that need to happen aren't actually in the document like they were in the National Nutrition Policy. And I think also the burden of responsibility on the Department of Health is a little bit unfair. I mean, other departments need to take their share of the burden of this problem, both in terms of food poverty and obesity and overweight. It shouldn't just be the focus of the Department of Health.
Mary.
Well, it's not the focus of the Department of Health. The Department of Health has produced this framework document, but it's an all of government, all of society, you know, community, individual approach. You know, what we want to see here is, you know, it's a healthy country, but it's healthy schools, it's healthy workplaces, it's healthy hospital campuses, it's healthy communities and healthy families. So it's not just the Department of Health. So everybody has a role to play. We haven't itemised everything in Healthy Ireland because it's not sort of just something that's full of specific things we're going to do. It's a framework of how we're going to work to address the many risk factors that are leading to sort of our chronic disease burden.
Final word from you, Donal. Are we fighting a losing battle, would you fear?
Well, I'd like to look on yesterday's report as saying maybe we're beginning to turn the tide. And I think a debate like this for an hour was unthinkable 10 years ago. So, you know, it is rising on the agenda. It's fantastic. And we need people to take home key messages. You know, milk and water should be the main drinks for kids. Physical activity for at least an hour every day. Yeah. Walking is the best type. You don't have to join a gym. And
don't eat the burger wrapper.
Don't eat the burger wrapper.
Just there is one concern which is slightly an aside, and that's with people who are in training and involved in sports and games.
Okay.
The level of
Andrew, I have to cut you off. We're out of time. Look, thank you very much indeed. Put the fork down, as we've been saying earlier tonight. Mary Mowens, Professor Donal O'Shea, Ella McSweeney, Andrew Doyle and Paul Kelly, thank you all. We're back on Tuesday at 10. Till then, have a lovely weekend.